Hello. Welcome to our program, the National Geographic Society, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Jim Cruz, and for the next half hour, I will be reading articles from the National Geographic magazine and website here on OWL Radio. We're continuing with our current copy of the National Geographic Society magazine, the end of the year edition, which is looking at photography. First is an article by Eric Larson. Her work explores the bonds connecting cultures, people, and nature. In this particular case, gentle marine survivors. There's a mural. Manatees, among other sea life, adorn a convenience store's mural in Crystal River, a coastal city in Western Florida, known as the manatee capital of the world. A refuge for the sea mammals operates there. We'd sit at the water's edge, on the seawall in front of Jenna's family home, and listen. Soon, we'd hear them, gusts of breath when the manatees came up for air, before sinking back down below the surface in up the spring-fed Florida Bay. I began calling them the sounds of the ancients, as these docile marine mammals' lineage leads back to grass-eating land mammals from about 50 million years ago. Yet in the places that manatees inhabit today, many populations are seriously threatened. Writer-photographer Jenna Steffens and I were paired at the National Geographic Mentorship Program in 2019 and had discussed working on a project together. I had moved to South Florida only a few years before, and Jenna was living in Columbia. She had spent many childhood days in Crystal River, Florida, known as the manatee capital of the world, at the home that was originally her great-grandmother's, on land facing the waters of a manatee refuge. During the pandemic, she decided to stay at that house for a few weeks, and on a visit, we began discussing ideas. In 2021, declining water quality wiped out many of the Atlantic Florida seagrasses that manatees eat, and more than 1,000 perished in what was particularly deadly year for the mammals. The same year, National Geographic approved our proposal to do a story on manatees, their essential relationship to the fragile Florida ecosystem, and where they're at risk or thriving. We made Crystal River our research base. Early in the morning, when I'd walk out, I'd be met by bursts of air from the surrounding water. The sounds of the ancients again. Jenna's roots in Crystal City revealed a lifelong fascination with manatees, and I quickly gained inspiration by spending time in their environment. One headline that drew me in, "Nobody knows how to wean manatees off coal plants," on a Bloomberg Businessweek report about manatees flocking to the hot water runoff from coal and oil-fired power plants as natural hot springs habitats grew scarce because of coastal development. As we did research on relevant science, environment, history, we came across a work of scientist and National Geographic explorer Jason Gully, who had been investigating issues surrounding manatees. After discussions with photo editor Kaya Barron, Jason was added to the team. He would take underwater and aerial photographs to reveal manatees' otherworldly habitat. Meanwhile, back on land, Gina and I would immerse ourselves in the culture of what's become an almost mythical being, on one hand threatened, on the other larger than life. Zigzagging across Florida and ranging up and down the coastlines, we found a complex web of human encounters with and feelings about manatees. Crowds of fans describe them fondly as gentle, huggable, lovable, sweet. Marine conservationists dedicated to the manatee's welfare warn that it's a canary in a coal mine, an animal that's in great danger itself and is also a bellwether of the danger in its surroundings. Thanks in part to manatees' popularity, Today, Florida's effort to conserve them has broad support from zoos, aquariums, museums, the U.S. Geological Survey, power companies, universities, and more. The feature story on which we collaborated is to appear in the January 2023 issue of National Geographic. The visual storytelling will include Jason's laborious underwater imagery, as well as my photography from land, which range from documentary to more whimsical vacation-style images that may jog our collective memory of Florida leisure. At the end of the journey, Jenna and I found ourselves again sitting on the seawall, considering the manatee's story and where it might lead us. For me, manatees have become a guide showing me a new primordial layer of this place where I live. Throughout our work on their story, they acted as mirrors to those who cross their path, to the places where they live, and to our relationship with the environment that sustains us all. Below the surface, they're a small and unusual group of herbivorous mammals playing an essential role in our ecosystem. Above the surface, charismatic icons with the ability to delight, enchant, and reflect the best part of humanity, they are the ancients, holding memories from long ago. Erica writes, Jenna and I would immerse ourselves in the culture of what's become an almost mythical being. Pictures. Gentle, lovable, huggable, even manatees get raves from fans, many of whom have never seen a real one, such as the sea cows hold on the popular imagination, displayed in murals, statues, clothing logos, and more. Some signs of Manitou mania that writer Jenna Steffens and I encountered in Florida. Clockwise from top. A manatee cutout. That's me hugging it at the Bishop Museum of Science and Nature in Bradenton. A mother and baby manatee mailbox in Crystal River. And fans Topaz Martofel and son Ryder Kramer, who came from Pennsylvania to attend the Florida Manatee Festival in Crystal River and swim with the docile mammals. Next, a toolkit fit for an elephant, photographed by Mark Thiessen. How do you protect a delicate camera while photographing a powerful and sometimes skittish animal? That was the dilemma faced by Jasper Dost last year when he was in Gabon to cover the effects of climate change on forest elephants. He needed a way to capture the foraging pachyderms without frightening them away from their food source. For help, Dost turned to National Geographic photo engineer Tom O'Brien, who designs and builds solutions for all kinds of field assignment hurdles. In this case, that meant developing an extraordinarily strong camera trap that wouldn't disturb the elephants or the area's protected trees, and making multiples of everything as a backup. Number one, camera trap housing. These are five camouflaged boxes, each with an overhang over where the lens would be. To withstand the pokes and prods of elephants, the world's largest land animal, O'Brien made steel rainproof containers that weighed 35 pounds when, quote, fully loaded, unquote. Number two, ratchets. And these are ratchets that pull down a load with. Instead of screws that might harm the trees, straps secured the traps. Wireless strobes are number three. Infrared flashes illuminated the elephants without scaring them away. Number four, beam break motion sensors. Two-part tool sent infrared light across a trail. When an animal broke the beam, that triggered the camera to take a photo. Ball heads. Several little things with attachments on it. Ball heads, they held the strobe to the mounting device. Number six, cameras. These are very small ones, about the size of a cell phone. These off-the-shelf items helped monitor the custom camera traps, but they were getting smashed and dusted, O'Brien says. Number seven, the passive infrared motion sensors. After detecting infrared energy emitted from an animal's body, they fired the camera shutter. Next is a whole bunch of looks like blue boxes. Oh, they're batteries. 60 lithium ones powered the traps and the strobes. And finally, number nine, dark green metal objects that are rectangular. O'Brien wielded heavy-duty supports for the traps. In total, the gear he designed for Dost tipped the scales at roughly 1,100 pounds. Our next story is about Aji Stayawan. One story has dominated this photographer's career, flooding on the island where he lives. On low coastal land in the province of Central Java, Indonesia, villagers from Timbulstoka prepare to add mud to their cemetery to raise it above the high tide line. Before adding mud, they must mark the locations of the graves with large bamboo sticks. I grew up in Central Java. My first job was working as a travel guide for visitors, then for student interns from Europe. That's when I started using a camera. And then I knew I wanted to be a photojournalist. I began to freelance, but I wanted more training. 2015, I got to go to Bali for the Foundry Photojournalism Workshop, where professional photographers teach students like me at low cost. That's the start. The workshop class taught by National Geographic contributor photographer Maggie Stieber, it's like I was a baby, or blind, or starting from zero. I tried to learn, and to hear every single word that Maggie said. At the end, there was a festival and awards for the best students in each class. Maggie called my name, Aji! I never expected something like that. What? And then I was crying on the stage. A few months after that, a press photo agency asked me to be a freelancer. Then one client gave me an assignment. Then others. 2017, I started photographing the sea rise and flooding of Demak Regency on the northern coast of Central Java, in hamlets and villages not far from my home. Some 17,000 named islands make up Indonesia. On my home island of Java, coastal areas are threatened by deforestation, sinking land from groundwater extraction, and rising seas caused by climate change. A few years ago, the worst flooding in Demak Regency, used to be from March until August, when tide waters entered homes for 6 to 9 hours a day. But in the last 2 years, it seems flooding has been unpredictable and has happened in other months. The ocean has engulfed thousands of acres. Once it was farmland, gradually changed into fish ponds and mangrove forests. Now it's submerged by rising seas. When I went to take photos, the villagers told me so many media are coming here and there is no change. After that, I tried to make this project more serious. Sometimes I go without my camera just to talk to people. They are so angry after many years of nothing being done to help them. In the past, people here were farmers, then became fishermen. The flooding changed their culture, their livelihoods. As I take pictures, they tell me how it was. In this area, everything is green, Aji. Everywhere, it's coconut trees. They still remember in their hearts. A man working on the road with a hoe told me, "You know, Aji, when I was young, this hoe was meant for farming. But now he tries to use it to fix the road because of the rising sea level. And it can't fix the real problem because the water keeps undoing whatever he does." The young men now, the children, they are moving to the city, leaving this story behind. Some of the elders have had a chance to leave, but they don't want to. They say, "I will adapt to these conditions, whatever it takes. If I have to be buried, I will be buried here. on the land of my ancestors. The flooding of the cemetery of Timbosoka village made it hard for the living to visit the graves of their ancestors or bury their dead. Over the years, I have visited there many times. In September 2021, I photographed the razing of the cemetery, which was often underwater. Villagers removed the gravestones and, using earth-moving machinery from the government, added 5 feet of soil. They put each marker back in place and added a new fence. This could save the cemetery for 2 more years, some villagers told me, but 18 months later, it already was washing away. Sometimes people say, okay, this is climate change, and maybe their home is far away, so they think it's not a problem. In central Java, my home is about 9 miles from the coastline, and now the water's intrusion from the coastline is about 4.5 miles, halfway to my home. These villagers are my neighbors. I feel they are sisters and brothers. We are the same life, same faith, same story. So people have to understand, if this is happening anywhere, it's a big, big problem to everyone. When I'm in my home, I always remember the people I have met while documenting this crisis of rising seas. I'll be taking a shower and thinking what the villagers have to do to get water. This year, their fresh water is going salty. I'll think, when they're asleep, there's water. When they eat, they're in water. And even their cemetery has been raised up. When they die, they'll be buried below sea level. But the holes that they dig will have the seawater inside. But life must go on. My job is to tell their stories. Picture Haji Staiwan stands in a tidal flood to photograph resident Kuzuma Yetun on her terrace. Her home faces the main road on the north coast of central Java, where sinking land, coastal erosion, and rising seas result in extreme flooding. Our next photographer, Wayne Lawrence. I think I'm somehow changed by everything and everyone I photograph. Summer 2022 found 2 National Geographic contributors in Dubon, South Africa, Brooklyn, New York, and Detroit-based photojournalist Wayne Lawrence and Atlanta-based National Geographic explorer Tara Roberts. For nearly a month, Lawrence shot portraits in a variety of settings and situation. Here, he discusses his work with Tara Roberts. Hey, Wayne. Hey, Tara. We've been traveling around Durban, and you, my friend, have been roaming the streets and finding people to photograph. How hard is it for you to approach strangers and ask to shoot their portraits? Well, it used to be very challenging for me to approach complete strangers, but so much of my success or failure depends on approach. I learned this early on. I'm naturally introverted, but my confidence has definitely blossomed over time. Roaming is an exhilarating process. It is what feeds all my work. What do you say to these people? Usually I'll greet someone and pay them a compliment. Then I'll introduce myself and explain exactly what I'm doing, and it's either yes or no. I've learned to never take the rejections personally. How do you even begin trying to capture the essence of a stranger in a photograph? Good question. Capturing someone's true essence is the most difficult thing about portrait photography, and I fail most times. Before I start making pictures, I am usually studying a person's body language, paying attention to gestures, expressions, etc., so I know what can work in a given situation. My approach is to always gauge a person's energy and try to match it. It's important to be fluid, though, and I'll know everything is gelling when there's no need to give much direction. Which image from this bunch most moved you? Well, there actually are a few, but one that really touched me is the image I made of a couple in their early 20s, smiling, sitting close together outside a Durban shopping center. They were definitely excited about being photographed. What I like most about their portrait is that I didn't initially put too much of myself into it. I just allowed their joy to bubble to the surface. Later in the session, I can see now that I was giving way too much direction. It was an edit when I realized that allowing them that space to just be made the best pictures. What about South Africa? Its people inspires you. South Africa, Mandela, struggle for liberation have always been a mystical place in my psyche. But since the dismantling of apartheid is relatively recent, I felt that it would be interesting to travel here and engage with communities. Are they not so far removed from that trauma? So far, I've been inspired by how alive people's eyes are, and I love how important having a sense of style is to people. You feel a personal connection to the country then? Absolutely. I do feel a personal connection to the country and the continent. Coming from the other side of the world, I'm an outsider. Still, I believe that we are one and the same family, and I approach everyone respectfully. The warmth I felt in Durban was so refreshing, even though I struggled to retain most of the Zulu language and that tongue click, especially. But somehow the faces, mannerisms, the swagger, all felt familiar to me. There was something interesting that happened off camera during your roaming. One day, in Overport, predominantly Indian neighborhood, an elderly Indian woman walked up to me in a very courteous way, asked me to photograph her. Then an African woman, who she didn't like, passed by, and she started cursing at her, calling her Blackie. Then she turned to me as everything was okay. I was more than a little disturbed. The way apartheid segregated communities of color is still present and devastating. Were you changed in any way as a result of this project? I think I'm somehow changed by everything and everyone I photograph. It all adds to life. Tapestry, no? I hear you. Where do you want to go with this project? What's your big vision? I'll definitely be returning to Durban. I like the idea of merging beach portraits with portraits of people in more urban areas. I'd love to turn this work into a book, citywide public exhibition in the town, then a traveling exhibition. I've also spoken to officials here about selecting a few photographers who are passionate about indigenous storytelling, workshopping with them and having their work exhibited as well. Excellent. I love this work and wish you much success. Thank you. Picture of a family. Indian Ocean waves lap the Durban beach. In the background, Asimantiba Sela and her husband Nati Sela flank their sons Anati and their daughter Iba Netha. Picture of a young couple. The warmth I felt in Durban was so refreshing. Streetwise, Vinder Mate and Lawrence look at frames. Below, Unati Magdalene and Shyamo Maratella enjoy the beach. Lynn Johnson. I'm in a park in Cleveland, but I happen to be visiting a friend, and I'm just looking for human touch, pure, simple. And here's this young couple lying in a hammock facing each other, legs intertwined. You can see them touching, but also you can feel it, her response to it, the quiet in her dreamy eyes. I have to get up the courage always. Doesn't matter how long I've been doing this. Hi, my name's Lynn. I'm about to start a project about touch for National Geographic. I saw you here. I thought maybe you'd have something to share about that. Do you mind if I take your photograph? Because I'm going to have to move into their personal space if they say no, I understand. But so often in my work, I'm looking for emotional truth, trying to make something invisible visible. I want to move in closer. I say yes. So now I know it's all right. And then I just stop thinking. I move around. I'm body and an eye, an appetite, a sensory gathering device. I want that moment. I want that beautiful light. I want the person on the other side of the camera to be respected and understood. A lot of it is patience. You know, that old sound in the movies where they're trying to tune a shortwave radio and you hear the buzzing warble of the dial as it searches. and my psyche, I'm doing that, trying to get all my fibers on the right wavelength. A project like this, writing about the science of human touch for the magazine's June 2022 issue, it's a partnership. Me, the photographer, Cynthia Gorney, the writer, Parallel Paths. As I began my own research, I was talking about the story to everybody. I mean, everybody, strangers in the grocery store. I wanted to know what people cared about. And as I read the scientific articles, I realized I was most interested in the intimacy of touch, the deep need for human connection. When the photo editor learned of an unusual refuge in Arizona, a farm where people with emotional or sensory challenges find comfort and gentle contact with rescued animals, I thought, touch, healing. Yes, photojournalism is all about looking outward, explaining to others. But we can't sustain this life if it's not at some level about us. I think that's where the powerful work happens, acknowledging that you're also doing it for yourself. At some point in my career, I saw how much my work pulls me close to people with complicated and difficult lives. I'm 5 feet tall, use a small, quiet camera, a Leica with no motor drive, so to some extent I'm able to minimize my physical presence. When I was a young photographer, I used to say, pretend I'm not here. But one day I heard myself, and how absurd that was. So what I've come to say is that, is it okay that I'm here? I keep checking in. I want them to articulate the response. And now I'm driving to Arizona with my own broken heart. My mother had just passed away. Get to the farm, saw a few animals, dust, harsh sunlight. I was going to need a way to sink in, to comprehend. The wonderful woman who runs the farm is a trauma survivor, incest and addiction. And it was listening to her story that showed me where to be, where to wait, what to gather. A child with sensory issues stood at the entrance to one of the paddocks warily and regarding a standing cow. She was standing there to feel the cow's warmth, but to be safe, had to wait until it lay down. Occasionally, storytelling moment comes at you all at once. I stopped thinking and got to work. Well, this is Christmas Eve. Just want to say Merry Christmas to all of you. May the blessings of the season and the reason for why we celebrate this time be with you. You've been listening to the National Geographic Society on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio, or you can listen by streaming on your computer or smartphone. Listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. Until next time, this is Jim Cruz saying goodbye from Owl Radio. Mm-hmm.